This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester. The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.
Super Furry Animals Rings Around the World is the album I'm talking about today on the XS Long Player. The fifth studio album from Super Furry Animals went to number 3 in the UK charts, and a bit of a triumph in terms of production and mixing techniques, as you will hear on today's show as I talk to Guto and Kian from Super Furry Animals about the making and memories behind this classic album. An album that was released in 2001 and nominated for a Mercury Music Prize, which gives a little hint as to how highly regarded it is. This is the final episode in this series of the XS Long Player, but if you've not listened to all the episodes so far, then there's plenty to go out over the next couple of weeks whilst we get season 3 ready. Interviews with Dodgy and Twisted Wheel and the Wombats and Pigeon Detectives, there's loads. So go and look back through the back catalogue, find your favourite albums and delve in to the interviews there to hear some fascinating stories about their creation. But let's get stuck into this chat with Guto and Kian. I've got to say, Kian's audio quality isn't the best on this episode, which I apologise for. I've cleaned it up best I can. I think whilst he was talking to me, he was also looking after his kids, maybe underwater in a cave somewhere the other side of the world with no phone reception. So it's a little bit noisy, it's a little bit bubbly, but hopefully you'll be able to get the best out of his stories, because he says some fascinating things about the creation of Rings Around the World, an album which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, by the way. In the week that we've recorded this interview, Super Furry Animals have just re-released this album in a load of different beautiful formats, including a double gatefold vinyl which has a load of extra studio sessions and retakes and different versions of the tracks on it. So that is available now if you're a big Super Furry Animal fan. But let's get stuck into it. Guto and Kian from Super Furry Animals talking about their classic album Rings Around the World. How you doing, boys?
Hello, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Let's start. Well, unlike most bands who I speak to doing the Long Player, this is a classic album that actually you as a band have had to come back to fairly recently. Normally when I speak to people, they've not listened to it for 6 or 7 years or something along those lines. But because, as I said, 20th birthday of this album, it's getting a re-release. What was it like coming back to Rings after 20 years since its release? I'm sure you've been back and explored it since its release, but kind of coming back to it with a bit of a fresh view.
I suppose it's the most obvious thing is the passing of time. 20 years is quite a long time when it hits home. A lot has changed in that time with how you make records and how records are presented and sold and how people devour music. It's quite different. This was the tail end, really, of analog world. Pre-broadband.
Does it feel like 20 years? Because as you say, 20 years is a long time. A lot changes, not just in terms of technology and the way music's consumed, but also in a person's life. I'm sure you guys were very different people with very different things that were important to you 20 years ago.
It feels like another life, to be honest with you. Someone pointed out I was 25 when we did that record. So it does feel like another life. And very often I'd ever go back and listen to a record once it's on the shelf. You just want to move on and go to the next thing, you know. Not being blasé, but it's like you're just always looking forward to the next adventure, the next discovery,
yeah.
Next bit of technology you want to embrace, and new ideas and collaboration. You know, it's always, I think as a band, you've always been forward-looking.
That's what I was going to say, because I think in general, particularly with musicians, they want to focus on the next thing. They want to focus on the future. So was there any hesitancy from your point of view as a band to go back and release something that was 20 years in the past? Or is there room for that, looking to the future and also celebrating the past at the same time?
You can argue it's a healthy thing to reflect. But again, we've never struck a formula either. Even if you did reflect, it wouldn't be in order to repeat. If we were still active in the studio, then this probably wouldn't be happening. what's the point? Because you're focusing on the now kind of thing.
We're going to reflect a bit over the next few minutes on the making of the album and your memories of it being released the first time around. And I think it's fair to say that this album marked a little bit of a change for Super Furry Animals. It was the fifth album, but at the same time, it was the first album that had been backed by one of the major labels. Did it feel like it was a long time coming to kind of get that backing from a major when you were making this album?
Well, Creation were always very good to us, and they never skimped when it came to making records. You know, they were flush with all the Oasis money, and they were very generous. At the same time, they were always an artist-led label. But yeah, it was definitely different going from working with a record company that had a small office, and, you know, on a Friday afternoon, everybody in the office would be out in the pub, 10, 15 people, where working with Epic or Sony, you know, you're dealing with people who were in a skyscraper in central London, quite a different environment. These people worked on Shania Twain records and J-Lo records and Beyonce records. And then our record came onto their desk one morning. They'd be working on us. Kind of more of a production line rather than, you know, Creation had a sound, didn't it? They had similar-ish bands on their label, essentially guitar bands. Alternative left-leaning bands, where Epic had all manner of bands.
Did that feel like it ramped up the pressure in terms of making the album, suddenly going from, like, say, an office of 15 people that I'm sure you all knew by name, I'm sure were kind of vocally very supportive of your music, to a what feels like, the way you describe it, a corporation, I guess?
Yes. Well, we were lucky with Epic that the guy who signed us, Rob Stringer, he seemed to be a genuine fan. So we didn't feel the pressure really there to, you know, we wanted to deliver and make a record that they were happy with and that other people would like, obviously. But we had confidence in what we were doing, that we would make them happy. And we preferred it, really, if they just butted out anyway.
I mean, if you think, like, the last Creation record we did was in Real World and we were there for 9 weeks, it doesn't get much more luxurious. So in terms of investment, you could say that was an equal amount of pressure, but I think Sony were probably preoccupied with the Fugees at the time, so they took their eye off us and let us get on with it. We embraced the opportunity. As with every record, you'd go in with an open mind and probably thinking, well, maybe this will be the last one, so you went for it. Knowing we had the financial clout, if we had silly ideas like, oh, let's do a 5-1 surround sound visual album, no one's done that before. Well, there's no harm in asking, because if anyone could, Sony could. It was an opportunity probably to realise some of the more ambitious harebrained schemes we've had.
It's interesting you say that potentially you were left to get on with it, that maybe they took the eyes off you a little bit, because I was listening back to this album and I'd forgotten how it started with Alternate Route to Vulcan Street, which is this really slow building kind of ethereal tune, I guess, which I imagine is one of those songs that it's really difficult to get a record company to buy into opening an album, because the kind of general consensus is hit them with your big songs, hit them with your party anthems first, hit them with the singles, and then you get to play around a little bit in the latter stages of the album. Was that a difficult one to get past the suits, for want of a better word?
I think at the moment, you know, you're dealing with streaming. I think labels like to have the hits at the top, you know, so people don't just switch off after a song. But I think it was slightly different. There was still the idea of an album then, and people were still expected to sit through 45, 50 minutes of music, because you've already invested in buying the disc anyway. Unless you taped it off a friend, you had to buy the record to hear it. So it's not like nowadays, I think it needs to be, or people want things to be immediate. I think it was quite normal to have quite a gentle intro into an album. I think of Stone Roses' second album. I think that first song is, you know, ridiculous, the way it, you know, takes ages to get going. And that's probably not the best example, actually. Stone Roses' second album isn't as highly regarded.
But I know what you mean. It's like there's a desire to take someone on a journey through an album.
Exactly.
Rather than...
Yeah, and I think that there was a willingness on the part of the listener to do that at the time.
People would expect that in an album format. It wouldn't come off as a surprise. It's probably the best example of surround mixing as well. So maybe, I don't know if that played an influence in the track listing. Probably not many people know, but yeah, it's quite impressive, the mix on that, to my mind anyway, still is. So maybe we just wanted to highlight, like showcase the surround system with that song.
I'm glad you brought up the mix, because I wanted to read you something that when I was trying to dig a little bit deeper into the album, I read something about the mix and the capabilities of surround sound that I did not understand at all. So I'm just going to read what I read to you and hope that you can explain it to me in a bit more, maybe layman's terms that I might understand. So this is from a review of the album. It says, the group were mindful of the capabilities of surround sound and recorded sub-bass on tracks such as A Touch Sensitive and Juxtaposed With You, which could only be heard through the low-frequency subwoofer channel in the surround mix. Does that mean that there's stuff on this album that can't be heard by the human ear?
No, it's just usually like hi-fi or whatever. They might not reproduce frequencies below, I don't know, 70 hertz or something. Depending on your system, it can go down to 25 or something. It's like what you're aware of, what you can maybe feel sometimes as well. It's not that you can't hear it, it's just you're more aware, maybe feel it more given a surround system than you would a small hi-fi. You wouldn't hear it on your phone, it'd probably make your speaker break, isn't it?
When we were mixing, we watched some movies because we were into the way movies sounded, because that's where the 5-1 thing came from. And we listened to some big Hollywood sort of blockbusters to see how they dealt with sub-bass. And, you know, something that will make the bottom of your trousers wobble rather than your, you know, something you're hearing through your ears.
For example, you couldn't put it on a vinyl because the needle will pop off. That frequency physically wouldn't exist on the vinyl because the cutting engineer would get rid of it because your needle would just pop off.
It's a great demonstration of how creative and embracing of technology you were as a band, and this was the first ever album to be released on CD and DVD at exactly the same time, I believe. But I think also in the music itself, it feels very varied and very creative as an album. There's a load of musical styles in there, loads of different genres kind of being pulled in. Where were those musical influences coming from? What were you feeding off to kind of get those ideas? And looking back at some of the reviews as well, there were a couple of people that kind of maybe criticised the album for not having an overarching theme, for maybe having too many different influences. How do you feel about those comments?
It's probably a fair comment, to be honest, because it is reflective of our influences. It was probably an amalgamation and a combination of years of influence as well, not just what was happening currently. I remember saying at the time as well, I think it was for The Guardian or something, that I'd never mix in stereo ever again. And then Napster happened, so that put an end to that. I think it was a healthy thing. Mixtapes was still a thing, I think, where you do compilation on cassettes for your mates and that. So having this journey and ups and downs and peaks and troughs made a totally natural process for us. Why wouldn't you not do that on an album format?
I think we were listening to a very varied palette of music. Although we came from a guitar background, we were also heavily into electronic music right from the very beginning. And I think around about this time, we'd been listening to a lot of drum and bass and a lot of hip-hop, as well as old and new guitar and psychedelic music. And the whole Britpop thing was so narrow in its outlook of music. It was, I like one kind of music, and that's guitar music. Well, we didn't listen to one kind of music, and we didn't think other people did either. Why isn't an Aphex Twin record? Why can't you listen to that and then listen to a Beatles record? You know, I imagine most people who are into Aphex Twin probably like a bit of Beatles as well, because they'll appreciate the studio trickery that they did in the 60s as well. It was just a reflection of what we were into ourselves.
And what excites us, yeah.
Yeah.
If you go in the studio and do the same thing that you did last time, then you're going to produce another formulaic, mundane reproduction of what you did last time, which, one, doesn't excite the listener, and certainly doesn't excite you as a band to go in and do the same. Try and do the things you didn't get to do in the last one, as opposed to, oh, that worked, let's do that again.
Sure. I'm going to ask you both to pick a track off the album in a moment, and it might be a favourite track, it might be something that sparks a particular memory about its conception or its recording, or it can be related to anything you like, but I'm going to ask you to pick one each. While you think about that, I wanted to just pull a track off the album and talk about it in more detail if possible, because I wanted to take a look at Respectable for the Respectable, which is a song that gets a well, has a musical credit to Paul McCartney on it. Can you tell me exactly what that's all about? Because I think to the untrained ear, to most ears, you wouldn't be able to hear Paul McCartney on that particular song.
Yeah, I'll talk about the song first. The song is in four parts. It's a song that would have started, I think, parts one and two. Maybe Griff had the chords and the melody and some lyrics. And it's a song that we just, as we were recording it, we just added bits to it. So it became quite a moving, changing song. We were at an awards ceremony, as you are, you know, as you used to do. And Kian bumped into Paul McCartney in the toilets and asked Sir Paul if he could do a remix. And you know, he just turned out to be the loveliest, most good-humoured man that you could possibly meet. And we ended up remixing some of his music. And then we had his phone number, Ben, which was always a handy thing to have. So, you know, let's get Paul involved with this record. And also being huge fans of the Beach Boys, we'd heard the story of Paul chewing carrots and celery for the track Vegetables, which was on Smile. And I guess in typical fashion for us, and probably frustrating for the label, no, we didn't ask him to sing or feature heavily on the record, but we asked him to chew celery and to chew carrots rhythmically as a percussion part in, I think it's part three. He was good enough to not see that we weren't just taking a mickey. He saw the beauty of the concept, and yeah, he said yes.
What level of direction did you have to give him in terms of chewing the carrots and the celery?
Well, just saying, keep in time, Paul. Keep in time, you know, don't wander there. Just keep in time. Keep the rhythm going. Keep people dancing. That's what you want to do, mate.
Come closer to the mic. Keep a bit roomy.
Yeah.
Right, so let's go and pick a couple of tracks off this album that you want to highlight, whether they're, like I say, memories, whether it's little musical moments that you'd like to celebrate. Kian, you can go first. What would be your pick from Rings?
Shit. I'll go to Bearsville. When we went at Bearsville, I think we were there for 3 weeks and we did maybe six songs. I recorded six songs. Receptacle was one of them. Actually, Receptacle was recorded in two countries or in two continents and mixed in a third country. It just kept growing, that one. Mm. But that was one song we did in Bearsville. But I recall a song called Patience, which didn't make the album. I think it was the B-side, but it made it onto the US mini accompanying album or something like that. So technically, it is part of the thing. Is when we did any album, all the songs was a body of work. So I just look at it as a body of work. Mm. I'll choose that one, an obscure maybe for some B-side. Does that count?
If you want it to count, it counts. Was there any regret that didn't make it onto the UK version of the album?
It was when I listened to it 10 years later and thought, why didn't this make the album? But I just think it's one of the best, my favourite mixes of the session. Chris Shaw was the producer. I think he instigated the move to Bearsville because he thought he had the best drum sound he'd ever heard. So that, I think that is evidence, yeah, in Patience as a song. It's sort of very moody, kind of, I don't know, to my mind, he sort of encapsulates the whole mood of the album for some reason. Weird, isn't it?
It's a left field choice. It wasn't the song I was expecting you to pick, I'll be honest with you. Guto, what about you? What would you go for?
Yeah, I don't even remember how Patience goes. So I'll check it out. The song I would choose, possibly my favourite song on it, is Run Christian Run, which was a song that I think Kian started with a piano line and a melodica line and a beat, possibly.
It was like a 303 bleep.
Yes, it would have a kind of a loop-based...
Acid country.
Like a piece of music that got developed into a song, I guess, and into that, into Kian's idea then, we brought in some pedal steel guitar, which I just think is the most beautiful instrument. And it's a song that it's one of my favourite songs that we've done. I mean, it's got some amazing sub-bass, if you ever get the chance to hear it, through the 5-1 mix. It seems to have all the ideas that we had going on into one coherent song. It stands up as a song and it stands up as a piece of recording and as stands up as a texture. Yeah, I'm a fan.
I'm going to pick a tune if that's all right, because I just want to confirm whether something's a rumour or whether there's any truth in it. And it's one of my favourite Super Furry Animal songs, actually. It's Juxtaposed With You, which, now, like I say, you get loads of rumours online and people telling stories and you never know what's true and what's not true. But did this song originally start out or was supposed to be a duet with Brian Harvey from E17? Or is that completely made up?
No, I think Griff strongly wanted Brian Harvey to be involved, but Brian didn't want to be involved. So,
what? Any particular reason why Brian Harvey? Was it someone he'd met before, or someone he just liked the voice?
No, he was a figure from tabloid news, essentially, that Griff found quite interesting, and I guess he probably wanted that kind of R&B vocal, and we ended up doing it through the vocoder instead. It would have been interesting.
Yeah, very unique. Before I let you go, obviously, this is the 20th anniversary of Rings Around the World. It's getting its re-release. It's going to be presented on 180-gram gatefold double vinyl, which whether the needle stays on it or not is another matter. The triple CD as well, double digital album, loads going on when it comes out. Also a load of added outtakes and remixes from the original sessions. When you came to re-release this album, was there ever any temptation to go back and, I'll use the word fix anything, but I'll put it in heavy inverted commas because I'm not sure anything necessarily needs fixing, but in terms of revisiting stuff and changing it in any way so it was different to the original, maybe more in line with what you heard at the time of creation?
Oh, I think that would have been just far too stressful. I mean, where'd you begin?
Pointless, even.
Yeah, pointless.
I remember I got the master tapes once to sample ourselves for the live show. I listened back to it and there's like, I have no idea how what was on that 2-inch tape ended up sounding like what was on record. That was just the magic that happened at the time. You know?
Guto, Kian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you about the classic album on today's XS Long Player, Rings Around the World. Good luck with the re-release and thanks very much for your time on XS Long Player.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Another XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.
Thank you very much for your time on today's XS Long Player. Cheers for your ears. That is it for today's podcast. In fact, that's it for this series of the XS Long Player. I'll be back in October with more of these podcasts, talking about classic albums with the people that made them. As I said at the top of the podcast, if you've not listened to the whole series yet, or the whole two series that are out, there are loads of different episodes to go at. Badly Drawn Boy, Kaiser Chiefs, Happy Mondays, Cortinas, Music, Block Party, Slow Readers Club, Embrace, just some of the bands that I've talked to over the last few months about classic albums from their musical pasts. So go and have a listen. If you like what you hear, please do leave a review, let others know what you think, and if you've got any suggestions as to your favourite albums you'd love me to cover on the XS Long Player, you can get in touch via a review, or you can get me on Twitter at Mr_JimBob, and I'll see you soon for another XS Long Player.
XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.